Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording at 1:45 PM, that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is March 6th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different classes. Now, let's just try and address the question that the vast majority of people, I think, are asking. And is this the market top? Are we on the cusp of a recession? Are we going to see a significant drawdown from current levels, or is this a buying opportunity? And these are, I think, some of the big questions. And when we look at historical comparisons and think about these types of questions in the broader context, I'm very conscious of the fact that a general is always fighting the last war. And therefore, we need to be alert to what is happening today, whereas also paying attention to what has worked in the past. The one thing that we are certainly sure of is that there has been extraordinary monetary accommodation over the course of the last decade, and we had never seen anything like that before, and it is likely to have had a distorting effect. Quite how it has distorted the markets and where those distortions have been most clearly in evidence is, I think, a topic for a lot of debate, and most particularly because, in my opinion at least, the most egregious overvaluations have been in the private sector, and you can't look at a chart for something that isn't listed. But what we have definitely seen over the last couple of days has been a rapid pricing in of the risk attached to the coronavirus. And we haven't had anything like this before. The last time we had a breakout even remotely close to the magnitude of this breakout was with SARS back in the early 2000s. But that was almost exclusively a hospital-borne illness. It was almost exclusively contained within a small number of countries in Asia. And it did not go global, but this one has. And there are cases everywhere. There were cases in London today of two baggage handlers at Heathrow. There was somebody who was checking people for infections at LAX in Los Angeles, also contracted the disease. So we can see that there is uncontrolled spread so far. It's not exponential, though. That's one of the, I think, the bigger points. Now, perhaps the reason why it's not exponential is because there isn't an exponential growth in the number of tests that are being conducted. That, unfortunately, is one of the big uncertainties. We simply don't know how big the problem is. And that is something that represents one of the bigger uncertainties, and therefore it is something that is getting priced into markets because the market abhors uncertainty. The transportation sector pulled back very sharply in here this week. It's another massive reaction against the prevailing trend, very similar in speed and magnitude to the pullback we saw at the end of 2018, and has come right back down to those lows in a matter of 2 weeks as opposed to 3 weeks last time. So now the question is it going to bounce? Now, this week we had the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by 50 basis points. Canada followed suit the day after and cut by 50 basis points. The day before, Australia cut by 25 basis points. China is engaged in clear assistance to the market. And so far, they have chosen to provide a great deal of regulatory assistance. And they have basically given payment holidays on debt. There won't be any defaults in China until this situation has improved considerably. Hong Kong is on the cusp of providing every permanent resident with 10,000 Hong Kong dollars in order to try and boost spending. But the problem is that because the spread of the coronavirus is now ramping up internationally, that the most deleterious effect is probably going to be felt in the second quarter. And we are really towards the end already of the first quarter, so it's quite likely that growth in the first quarter is going to be reasonable, but in the second quarter is likely to disappoint. And that's particularly the case for the USA. But for China, first quarter growth is probably going to disappoint on the downside, and come in quite a bit below what it was originally anticipated. And it may even be slow to recover in the second quarter. One of the things that has been quite clear is that China's stock market has been outperforming this week. And I think that is particularly relevant because I think there's an increasing possibility that global investors are looking at China on a first-in, first-out basis, and opining at least that since China was the epicenter of the problem to begin with and has introduced some of the most draconian measures to try and contain the spread, that it will be the first out. I don't know how good that judgment is likely to be, but it does appear to be what the conclusion that investors have reached, and the relative strength that China has exhibited over the course of the last couple of weeks is really quite impressive compared to the size of the pullback we've seen, for example, on the S&P 500. I think it is particularly relevant to look at the S&P 500 and to think about it in terms of the consistency of its trend, because we've had three medium-term consolidations, and each one of those has lasted anything from a year and a half to 2 years. Each has consolidated in the region of the previous peak before breaking out, and then has come back to test the upper side of the underlying trading range. Now, it consolidated in the region of the peak. It has now come back in to test the upper side of the underlying trading range. If it finds support here and can push back above the 3,000 level, well, then it will have followed suit. So the S&P 500, despite the fact that it has come back in a very aggressive manner, is still in the region of this 3,000 level. The technical deterioration has not been so acute that it can't be repaired. I think that is one of the most important factors here. Now, what happens, on the other hand, if we see additional downside next week? If we see additional downside next week, then it's going to represent a failed upside break. And if we get a failed upside break, well, then that is holding out the prospect that it is going to go all the way back down and test the lower side of the range. And the lower side of the range is a lot closer to 2,500 than 3,000. It's also worth considering that there have been precious few examples of an index that has sustained a move below the 1,000-day moving average and still been in a secular bull market. And that would suggest that the 1,000-day moving average right now is at 2,636. If the market pulls back further from where we are right now, then that does represent a potential area of support. And of course, the big question is how much damage has been done to consumer demand? What is that going to do in terms of corporate profitability? And can the accommodative measures that have been introduced so far and are yet to come going to support economic activity enough to try and turn the sentiment around again? We're still at a very uncertain moment. So the S&P 500 has at least paused in the region of the upper side of the underlying range, and the Nasdaq 100 has not broken below its 200-day moving average. So it was really quite overextended relative to the trend mean, and it has now completely unwound that overextension. back in 2018, it broke lower and then subsequently rebounded in a clear and sustained fashion. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we do get a further process of consolidation. But again, it is the 1,000-day moving average is, I think, one of the biggest hallmarks. Although we can certainly see with the Nasdaq 100, it has not been a particularly useful area of support during the decade-long bull market. Now, when we look at the Russell 2000, then I think we're given additional information here. We had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend at the end of 2018. We had a prolonged range in 2019. It then failed to break upwards to new all-time highs, has come back in a very dynamic manner over the course of the last 2 weeks and pushed down to a new reaction low. Now, it could bounce from here, but it has got a lot of work to do in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. So the clear conclusion we have from looking at US indices is there's been a loss of uptrend consistency and there has certainly been an uptick in volatility. But when we look at Europe, the weakness of the dollar has perhaps cushioned the decline for Wall Street. It has exacerbated the decline in Europe. So the Euro Stoxx index has pulled back in an extremely dynamic manner over the course of the last 2 weeks. The dynamic of the failure to sustain the breakout above 400 is much larger than the dynamic of the breakout. That certainly holds out the prospect it is going to come back down and test the lower side of the range. Well, the lower side of the range is anywhere between now where the price is right now, and approximately 330. So there is potential for additional downside here. If, on the other hand, it were to sustain a move below 300, well, then that does hold out the prospect that this range is not about to be resolved on the upside, but rather it is going to persist for a while longer. And of course, the lower side of the range, of the very long range, is 150. But we would need to see a profound economic slowdown in order to, I think, give any kind of credence to that kind of decline. But nonetheless, a clear upper dynamic is going to be required to confirm a return to demand dominance. When we then think about Japan, it has been ranging between 20 and 24,000 for the last 2 years, and it is rapidly now coming back down towards the lower side of that range. That entire 2 year range looks like a first step above the long term base formation, because 20,000 had been an area of resistance for decades and now has offered support for more than 2 years. So I think that's an important consideration. If we think about what could represent the kinds of activities that would lead to a recession, then we need to pay particular attention to the money markets. The Federal Reserve cutting interest rates by 50 basis points has certainly had a knock-on effect. When we think about the yield curve spread, then that, I think, is something which is going to have certainly an influence on sentiment. Now, when we look at the difference between the 10-year and the 2-year, it did get down. And I'm not at all sure that this is the correct spread. Yes, it did get down to zero, and that, yes, this is the correct spread in August. It has rebounded, and it has subsequently not sustained a move above 50 basis points. I think the clear message from the yield curve spread is that an inversion is a lead indicator for a future recession, and we have had an inversion. But it is generally when the yield curve spread surges higher that we get a clear and present danger are an urgent signal that a recession is imminent. So it has not surged higher, and in fact it contracted somewhat in here today, and part of the reason why it contracted was because of the incredibly powerful compression on the long end of the curve. Now, if the Federal Reserve were to cut interest rates an additional 50 basis points, well then that would, I think, put further pressure on the markets, and it could see the spread starting to expand again. That would be something that would generally be considered to be contractionary. It's not generally until we see the yield curve spread starting to peak out, often around 300 basis points, that we see the banking sector starting to lend once more. And I think it is quite clear that we do have bottoming characteristics over the course of the last 18 months in this spread. It is also worth looking at, for example, the spread between the 3-month and the 30-year, or well, it is actually the other way around, and that is up to 83 basis points. Now, when we look at this one over a longer time horizon, it does generally tend to become more inverted. It hasn't done so on this occasion, but it is now moving higher. Now, if this one breaks above 100 basis points, well, then that is going to be, I think, something that we need to pay attention to in terms of recession risk. So, just simply from looking at these two different sets of charts, well, what we can say is that the recession risk has increased, that the yield curve spreads are no longer contracting. They are starting to base, and there is the potential that they will eventually break out. So then the question is this we're going to have a recession soon, or we're going to have a recession later? Oil prices are contracting, and OPEC was unable to reach an agreement in here today, so Brent crude fell almost 10% and was down $4.50, breaking substantially down from the lows, or from the potential to find a low in the region of the nadir from back in 2018, breaking below the psychological $50 area and doing so in a dynamic manner. Now, when we look at the West Texas Intermediate, it was also down in a dynamic manner and coming right back down to the $40 area. I think one point that is there is two different ways of looking at this. The first is that it is spikes in oil prices have been some of the clearest causal factors in creating recessions. But that's not what we're seeing right now. Rather, it is the very acute contraction in energy prices is a reflection of excess supply and not enough demand. Therefore, thinking about oil as being a reliable lead indicator for a recession on this occasion is probably not going to be beneficial. Oil prices have been coming down because there is plenty of supply and there is massive disruption in the energy sector and in the transportation sector. The success of battery-powered vehicles and the fact that an increasingly large swathe of the globe is legislating to promote the use of battery-powered vehicles, regardless of the fact that most of the car manufacturers have yet to figure out how to actually make money from selling them, they are being pushed rather aggressively. Against that background, the supply of oil from unconventional sources has been a complete game changer for the energy sector, and that has contributed to the US becoming the greatest producer of oil in the world, pumping, I think last week, they hit a new record for production of 13 million barrels within the last week. So they're pumping as much as they can, but the price keeps falling, and there is a substantial proportion of the sector is in high yield, and high yield spreads in energy are now at 900 basis points. And this is leading the expansion in high yield spreads generally. So we can certainly then look at just the wider high yield sector. And it's up to 510 basis points as of yesterday. But the high yield ETF was down in a dynamic manner in here today. So it is reasonable to expect that when that high yield spread chart is next updated, that it will be above the 510 basis point level. This is before we see a raft of defaults, or of perhaps not yet default, but of companies being downgraded. When, for example, and I have written about this before, but when, for example, we look at Marriott Hotels, they have a debt to common equity ratio of 1700% and a price to book of 51. Now, the sustainability of its debt situation was possible if the global economy had continued to expand, and that we were going to have growth persisting, and the Chinese economy delivering oodles of new tourists all over the world. But that's not what's happening with the coronavirus, and we've had a meaningful drawdown over the course of the last 2 weeks. It is now back in the region of the lows from 2018, and if occupancy rates are not going to be anywhere close to full in any of their hotels anywhere, well, that is going to start to weigh on the ability of the company to continue to function as normal. So they took on an enormous amount of debt to buy Starwood, and the sustainability of that merger is something that is probably going to come into question. Now, when we look at, for example, a restaurant provider like Darden Restaurants, it has also pulled back in a very abrupt manner. So we have these massive reactions against the prevailing trend, and there is the clear potential here that this is the end for some of these restaurants, going from 40 to 120 in the space of about 5 years. And that is a pretty impressive advance, and subsequently giving up approximately a third of its value in the space of 2 weeks is something that is going to chasten a significant number of investors. It suggests that there is going to be a prolonged period of support building before some of these shares can continue or can improve. Something that I think is particularly relevant is that the bond yield has been contracting at an alarming rate. So the 10-year yield has compressed to 76 basis points by the close in here. Now, this is an incredible move, with the yield halving in the space of about 3 weeks. And when we get these kinds of very acute moves, then one has to consider that there's an enormous acceleration that's occurred and a huge flight to quality. So now the question is, how long can that persist for? Now, the big question in terms of addressing I think the big query most people have of whether we're on the cusp of a recession, I think there is the potential that we are going to have a recession in the US, almost certainly in much of Europe, potentially also in Australia, and a significant knockdown to growth in some of the emerging markets. It is very clear that if we're going to see assistance coming through, it needs to happen soon. One of the biggest reasons why recessions turn into crashes is because central banks don't act quick enough. Well, the Federal Reserve is now expanding its balance sheet once more. And that's incredibly important because until last week, they were still talking about tapering their assistance to the repo market. And the one thing that the locking up of the repo market told us last year was that there wasn't near enough liquidity in the financial system. The fact that they've been cutting interest rates, well, that denudes the banking sector of its ability to charge a margin on their loans. So they're not in a position to participate. Then, on top of that, you have the knock-on consequences of Basel III, where the primary dealers in the fixed income markets simply do not have the float to provide assistance to the repo market. And therefore, it falls to the Federal Reserve. Now, they've never had to engage in assistance to the repo market before, but considering the slowdown that is apparent, it is, I think, very likely and potentially absolutely necessary for the Federal Reserve to step in and provide a standing repo facility. Now, on the one hand, that opens up their balance sheet to unlimited liability. And on the other, it is absolutely and completely necessary. I'm posting a report from the chaps at Credit Suisse in here today. I think it is one of the best I've seen in terms of explaining the interrelationships in the financial plumbing of the global money markets. But one of the points that they make, which I thought was particularly relevant, was when companies suddenly can't make payments and when they are not getting the business or their invoices are not getting paid because of difficulties with corporations elsewhere, then their banking sector needs to step in to provide additional liquidity. When the banks are constrained from doing so, the central bank has to come in and provide liquidity. And then they need to tap their foreign currency reserves. A lot of those foreign currency reserves are parked in US treasuries. Well, if they had to sell their US treasuries to try and support their domestic economies, then that's going to put upward pressure on the US 10-year treasury and all of the US government's borrowing costs. Well, the US government cannot afford to pay more for borrowing, and therefore, it isn't really a question of if the Federal Reserve is going to engage in a standing repo facility. It is really only when. They have to provide the assistance required because to do other than that would put a great deal of upward pressure on the US government's yield and handicap the ability of the Treasury to fund itself. So what that pretty much ensures is the size of the Fed's balance sheet is going to increase. So that obviously then begs the question, well, how big is it going to get? And I think it's been my view now for quite some time that we have an example of that. It's the ECB. They took €1 trillion out of circulation and then they put in 2.6 to try and curtail the deflationary impact of that tightening. Now, if we go back and think about the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, well, if we simply think that they took approximately $750 billion out of circulation, I think it is not beyond the bounds of possibilities at all that the size of their balance sheet could next peak out somewhere around $6 trillion. And if we're talking about a stimulus in the region of an additional $1.8 trillion from where the balance sheet is right now, then that is something that is going to help to sustain the market. So the big question that comes after that is, if that is the kind of stimulus that the Federal Reserve is going to implement, it's quite likely to put downward pressure on the dollar. And what we've certainly seen in here this week was a substantial move in the euro. And the euro has rallied now and broken its downtrend against the dollar over the course of the last couple of years. It's not as if Europe is going to be a bastion for outsized economic growth, considering its reliance on exports. But the rally in the euro and the rally in the yen have been symptomatic of the unwinding of carry trades. If we get that kind of stimulus coming through, that I think is more likely than not, and I think there is a better than even chance that it's going to be announced at the next Fed meeting. Well, it's quite likely then that we're likely to see the unwinding of carry trades probably end. But the big question, and it's a question we don't know the answer to, is what is going to be the knock-on effect of the coronavirus? And is it the spread of the virus going to be contained by the beginning of summer? Weather is going to start to get warmer from approximately April onwards. Then we're going to hit summer. The flu season generally does tend to moderate in the summer and then picks up again in the winter. If the clear comparison with the coronavirus is the 1918 or 1919 flu, well, then there is the potential that it will come back because it will become endemic and that we will have a further outbreak the second time around. That is going to push the response of the healthcare sector even further. Now, we're a lot better technologically equipped to deal with a second outbreak on this occasion than they were back in the early 1900s. The fatalities in the second outbreak were by far the largest. That is also part of the reason why there was an armistice in at the end of World War at the end of World War I. People were dropping left and right from the Spanish flu in the trenches. And it was in the fall of 1918, and the armistice was in November, the 11th hour of the 11th month, the 11th day of the 11th month. So that will tell us that we know that there is the potential for the virus to resurge after summer. But it does give the global healthcare sector that extra time in order to come up with solutions. And the incentive to come up with a solution, it couldn't be higher. So I think the one thing that we do need to be aware of is that sentiment is going to get worse. The kind of apocalyptic projections that are starting to come out are predicting the end of the world as we know it. And we don't have any evidence that support has really been found just yet, or that the kind of monetary assistance that I'm predicting is in fact going to happen. And we are going to see the fatalities rise, and eventually it's quite likely that there are going to be fatalities in an increasingly large numbers of towns and cities all over the world, because the containment of the virus has not been effective. And that is also going to be deleterious to sentiment. And it means that I think when Sequoia say that they're expecting it to be several quarters before we have clear visibility on what the repercussions are going to be, I think that's probably accurate. Therefore, it's likely that we are going to have a medium-term correction in stocks. That has been apparent now for a while, that the potential for a very swift rebound like we had at the beginning of 2019 has certainly ebbed over the course of the last week. I think it is important, though, to bear in mind that the problems that we have are not unaddressable. And the spread of the virus is it's probably going to get worse, and that volatility could quite easily spike. When we look at some of the measures for pressure in the financial system, the TED spread broke its sequence of lower rally highs in here today. Now, it is still quite compressed, and it would really need to be surging through the upper side of this base formation around the 70 basis point level to signal that we are getting illiquidity becoming an issue in the banking sector. When we think about the performance of banks, they are experiencing some significant headwinds from the compression in yields, or excuse me, the compression in interest rates, and then the lack of demand. The FTSE 350 banks is back on the lower side of the range over the course of the last decade and plumbing the depths. And certainly, there has been a downward bias to trading over the course of the last couple of years. When we look at Australian banks, then they are also under pressure in here, and they have been trending downwards for a while and broke down in here today. The TOPIX Banks Index is also under pressure and is back in the region of its lows from 2016. So there's a lot of commonality in the underperformance of the banking sector already. And when we see that on a global basis, it is supportive of the view that there is a problem in the banking sector and that they are going to have significant difficulty in being able to extend credit in such a low interest rate environment. So that is definitely part of the problem, and it does suggest that there is going to have to be significant remedial activity performed by central banks and governments all over the world in order to correct it. The availability of dollars has been boosted by the weakness of the US dollar. That's certainly true. Then we need to pay attention to some of the emerging markets, particularly those that have been among the better performers. So, for example, Brazil in here this week has broken below its 200-day moving average, and it is pulling back in a rather dynamic manner. And its currency is also looking rather susceptible to additional weakness, and it is cruising, the dollar is cruising through 450 in here this week. The other big moves we've had in here this week were in the Indian rupee, where the rupee has weakened substantially over the course of the week. The banking sector has had to absorb the merger of State Bank of India with Yes Bank, but at least that merger has ensured that the non-bank lending sector is going to become less of an issue, and that you have a state-backed bank now helping to support that market. So that is a positive development for the Indian economy. But then when we think about some of the countries that should have benefited from the migration of manufacturing from from China because of the trade war, Vietnam is right in the region of the lows over the course of the last couple of years. When we think about where some of the funding issues, if there were a shortage of dollars, might turn up, it's in a number of the Asian countries. they do have substantial buffers, particularly following the Asian financial crisis, but that hasn't preserved them from weakness. The fact that the South African rand is at a new low is certainly also worthy of consideration. And then, of course, Turkey has got some significant issues as well. Their currency, however, was stronger in here today. Argentina is another country that we need to pay attention to because of the risk that it is going to default again. So, when we think about where the risks are, it's about an exaggeration of all of the concerns that people had a year ago about where the problems were, whether that is going to be a slew of defaults from fallen angels being downgraded from investment to junk status in the bond markets, whether it is in some of the most over-levered of the emerging market countries where Argentina, Turkey, and South Africa have got themselves into rather difficult fiscal situations, whether it is the banking sectors globally that are trending downwards and experiencing a great deal of pressure. Even, for example, Deutsche Bank, which had been the best performing share in Germany over the years to date, has unwound all of its advance in here. So there is certainly downward pressure coming on the banking sector. And the underperformance of banks is a lead indicator for future recessions. That does suggest that there is a problem. And we know that high yield spreads are not yet breaking higher, but that they are moving higher and they're being led higher by the high yield energy sector. So I'm very conscious of the fact that I've spent most of this broadcast talking about where the problems reside. Now let's think about what kind of opportunities that is likely to result in. Are we at the end of a secular bull market, or is this a recession in a secular bull market? There is no bull market has persisted without occasionally having a recession and a medium-term correction. I think that's probably where we are, that we're due a recession. The market has gone a decade without having one, and we're due a slowdown in growth. When we think about corporate profits, then we know that corporate profits have been doing not much of anything for most of the last 5 years. In fact, it's more like 7 years. So that doesn't get updated all that often, but it does suggest that we get a lot of margin, multiple expansion to justify where prices have traded up to over the course of the last 7 years. Corporate profits could quite easily contract, given the knock-on effect to the economy from spreading or the spread of the coronavirus. When countries are keeping kids home from school and foreign travel is being curtailed, and the willingness to eat at restaurants or to go to sporting events or to congregate for concerts is being cancelled, then that does have a knock-on effect for spending, and it does have a knock-on effect for velocity of money. So there is certainly the potential that some of the most aggressive forecasts for corporate profits and earnings are going to have to be tailed back, and then that is something that is going to result in additional downward pressure for stocks, and these do tend to have a self-feeding nature to them. So the reliance of the market on liquidity has perhaps never been more important. Now let's think about, well, how far could some of these shares fall? The big argument at the moment is that the massive compression in government bond yields has resulted in a bid for the kinds of companies that have been reliable dividend payers for a prolonged period. So, for example, McDonald's has been ranging really for the last 6 months. It hasn't really broken down. But when we look at its yield, I think it's quite clear that when we look at back history, over the course of the last decade, it has found support in the region of 3.5% level on multiple occasions. So the yield could expand by an additional 100 basis points before we get a substantial yield-based bid coming into the market. But that 3.5% level has been a bit of a magic number over the course of the last decade for these dividend aristocrat type companies. So it's been equally efficacious around or for Procter and Gamble. That's also been true of Johnson and Johnson, and Johnson and Johnson has found support around the 3.5% level on numerous occasions. When we look at Nestlé, it's an equally there is also this tendency to find support in the yield around the 3.5% level. Well, we've had a really quite impressive advance in highly defensive sectors. And the relative strength of utilities and consumer staples, and not least because of basic material hoarding as in response to the fear of the coronavirus, we've seen certainly the consumer staples and utility sector hold out. It is worth considering, though, that highly defensive sectors generally do tend to do well in the latter stages of a bull market. And the fact, for example, that British American Tobacco bounced in here this week is a bit of a standout. The fact that it hasn't continued lower, that people have had more on their minds than shorting the tobacco stocks, is a testament to just how much selling pressure has been going on. So we know that there is certainly going to be some kind of demand coming through for consumer staples and dividend aristocrat shares if yields do tend to expand. But the other side of this equation is that we need to be alert to the fact that this downward pressure on yields is something that is both a safe haven, but it's a response to the clear downward pressure on or the pressure on central banks to lower interest rates. And the number of bonds that are currently trading with a negative yield is around 14.4 trillion. And that's mostly Europe and Japan. The government bond yield on the UK is within basis points of going negative. And following today's move, the 2-year is down to 6 basis points. When we then think about Australia, it's certainly below 1% right across the curve, down to 39 basis points. When we think about Canada, it was another holdout, and yields there are still reasonably high, and at 2-year, about 70 basis points. But the clear message here is that the yield is contracting, and that we're likely to see an increasing number of countries see their bond yields go negative. And that is a factor that has helped to sustain these dividend companies. That's one of the reasons why they haven't pulled back already. It's because there is a clear demand for yield, because the answer to any big problem that arises is devalue the currency. Well, devaluing the currency is the primary reason why people buy gold. It's the barometer against which all other currencies are measured, and it remains really quite firm. and it unwound most of the decline put in today. Gold has been rather volatile over the course of the last couple of weeks, but part of the reason for that was because of the initial contagion selling. I think the most important thing that's happened this week has been some differentiation coming through and looking at the sectors that do benefit from the kind of environment that we're presented with right now. Gold is a sector that can truly benefit it, the more bonds have a negative yield. It is obviously an asset that doesn't pay a dividend, but having no dividend is better than a negative return. And that is one of the clear factors sustaining this breakout that began really in June of 2019. There is clear potential that it is going to persist because the impetus is certainly on the upside, regardless of what currency one looks at. So gold is strengthening in every currency because the response from central banks is going to be to devalue their currencies in order to deal with the challenges that are being presented. So that is one of the clear factors supporting gold prices. Silver has been considerably more volatile, but it is now firming from the region of its trend mean. It has been ranging below the psychological $20 level since 2014, and I think it is more likely than not that it is going to follow the gold price higher. Platinum was firmer in here today and started to steady again as it comes back up towards the trend mean. $1,000 is the upper side of platinum's base formation. When we look at gold miners, they pulled back extraordinarily violently last week and then rebounded rather impressively this week. It's going to have to sustain a move above $30 in order to demonstrate a return to medium-term demand dominance. And I think that that is more likely than not, for the simple reason that the vast majority of the major miners have got all-in sustaining costs in the region of $800 to $900, and gold is quite likely to trend north of $1,700 in the not-so-distant future. And those kinds of margins are not observable all that often in the commodity markets. Commodity prices generally have been quite weak, but I think what was important to see in here this week is that the London Metals Index did not accelerate down. In fact, it has bounced around in the region of the lows put in from the beginning of February. So China is getting back to work, and Starbucks anticipated that, or announced in here today, that they anticipate getting most of their facilities open again in China over the course of this month. The share did break down over the course of the last 2 weeks. It's certainly pricing in a negative quarter, or potentially two. But these kinds of viral outbreaks do not last indefinitely, and people will rediscover their lust for life once the fear has subsided. One of the things I'm very much reminded of, two points that David made over the years. The first is that a crisis has to be seen to be getting worse in order for it to continue to have a deleterious effect on markets. Now, there is the potential that this crisis is going to get worse. I think over the course of the next week, that is very likely. But the longer it persists for, and the more efforts are underway to contain the spread, then it is more likely that we're going to start seeing better news. The thing to watch, and the data that I'm most alert to in terms of monitoring the coronavirus, is the growth in the number of cases. Because when that peaks internationally, it's likely to mark a low in the market. That was exactly the same with SARS in 2003, despite the fact that they're two very different diseases, and that it is and that the coronavirus on this occasion has been much more widely spread. The logic for where the low should be is identical. When the growth in the number of new cases peaks, that is likely to be the low in the market. The other point that David had made was that a secular bear market is defined by a period of rising dividend yields and valuation contraction. And he had often given the example of ExxonMobil, which had traded at a dividend yield of 10% back in 1982. Well, the share is now accelerating lower. It was over $100 back in 2014, and it's at 47 in here today. And the dividend yield is up now to approximately 7.3%. Well, 7.3% is not quite yet 10%, but it is still very high, and it is assuming an inability of the company to continue to pay. Well, we may get to a point where Exxon does in fact cut its dividend. I think it's more likely that they will cancel buybacks first. Now, canceling buybacks is obviously something that is going to be a very significant factor for investors. Buybacks have been by far the biggest contributor to stock market performance over the course of the last decade. And the PKW Buyback Achievers Index pulled back really quite sharply in here today, or in here over the last 2 weeks. It failed to sustain the breakout, and it has pulled back and made a new low. Now, it needs to bounce and bounce soon if the top formation isn't going to be very much clearly in place. So, buybacks are probably the biggest risk. But even the question about buybacks is mitigated by the extraordinarily low interest rate environment, because it would be reasonable for companies to say that they're going to borrow over the course of the next year to sustain their dividend and buy back shares, because they believe that the shares are undervalued and that growth is going to pick up. And that is the kind of argument that pension investors would be willing to support. So, what we could anticipate is one of the knock-on effects of this trading environment is, in fact, that buybacks may accelerate rather than decelerate. Now, if that's the case, then we are likely to see a low come into the market in the short term rather than the medium term. And I think it is particularly important to pay attention to the consistency of charts. We have had these massive reactions against the prevailing trend. It has already resulted in action by central banks, and we're likely to see more of that. The potential is that we are going to have a surprise on the downside in terms of economic growth. And gold is certainly the sector that is performing most consistently right now. If we are going to avoid a much deeper process of consolidation and unwinding of valuation expansion, then we need to see a very clear effort to support the repo market and to make ample liquidity available. I think that that is the most likely scenario, but it does need to happen in order to retain a reasonably sanguine environment. I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you. And I would like to say, stay safe.